At the airport later, when the Pakistani press asked for comments, Wilson deferred to his liberal colleague George Brown. It was part of Charlie's political artistry to know when to yield and to let the issue become Brown's, not his. Back in Washington, however, only one congressman stepped forward to lead the battle. With Dennis Neal by his side, Charlie was now moving through the congressional directory calling every person he had ever done anything for. "This is payback time," he would say. It was that basic. He was calling in his debts. Neal offers the best explanation of why Charlie and he finally pulled off their victory at 5 a.m. in the House-Senate conference. "Most of Congress is about words and debating, and you can never really resolve anything. But appropriations is simply about money, and it's very practical." The trade-offs were explicit. Charlie wanted money for Zia. He wanted his colleagues to give him the money. He had done it for them before. He would do it for them again. "Are you with me, or are you with Solars?" is the way he put it to each of his colleagues. Everyone knew that Charlie would remember forever which side they chose. The morning of the showdown, Charlie Schnabel, who had come into the office early, long before anyone else, picked up the phone, which would not stop ringing. It was Zia calling simply to pass on encouragement. "Tell Charlie to put on his wrestling togs and do battle." At stake were hundreds of millions of dollars. Pakistan had become America's third biggest aid recipient after Israel and Egypt, and the battle to cut it off culminated at the House-Senate conference that night. As Dennis Neal described it, "The joint conference is like a poker game. To be a real player, you have to know what you're doing. You have to know how to read the other players, and you have to know when to make your move." When the game began, the master lobbyist could only sit outside the door and wait to see how his ace would fare. Wilson's profound difficulty that night was that the anti-Pakistan coalition on the committees had the votes to defeat him. Understandably, they wanted and repeatedly asked for a straight up-and-down vote, but Charlie used his first maneuver to trump them. He was, in effect, able to set the agenda insofar as aid to Pakistan was concerned, because he had a deal with subcommittee chairman Dave Obey. The first thing he had done was to make sure the divisive issue would not be brought up until the very end, when members would be tired and eager to get home. Secondly, he knew that Obey would find a way not to permit a direct vote. David Obey didn't like Zia or his bomb one little bit, but he owed Wilson. Charlie was the chairman's secret instrument for maintaining discipline and control of the subcommittee. Charlie wasn't exactly a conservative. He was, in fact, a liberal when it came to domestic matters, civil rights, women's issues. But on gun control, anti-communism, and defense, he was a hardliner second to none. And that permitted him to position himself as an honest broker for Obey with the conservatives. With Charlie on board, Obey could always report out a full bill without having to worry about it being opened up on the floor. He thus avoided the risk of losing all of the horse trading and consensus building that had gathered those endless line items into a semblance of coherence. That's what Wilson gave to Obey, but it was a two-way street. On this occasion, it meant the chairman had to hold his nose and champion Charlie's bomb-hungry Muslim despot. "I'd never seen the chairman let another member dominate an issue like that," recalls staffer Steve Goose, who became increasingly distraught at what he saw as a mind-bending power play on Wilson's part. Goose had walked in certain that the liberal coalition his boss Bob Mrazek had helped organize was going to cut Zia's aid. "We had the votes, and we had the law on our side." By 3 a.m., however, Charlie had already pulled off a legislative miracle, with a large portion of the administration's original funds restored to Pakistan. But Wilson still wasn't happy, and neither Obey nor Obey's Senate counterpart, Chairman Daniel Inouye, were willing to risk his anger. They both realized that Wilson was prepared to go to the floor if he didn't get what he wanted. That was the second trump card Charlie held that night. He and Neal believed that if they took the issue to the floor, they had the votes to win. For Obey and Inouye, there could be no greater nightmare than to fail to report out a complete bill. Anarchy would break out if the two chambers began voting on each individual line item. And so the late night and now early morning poker game of bets and bluffs continued, with Inouye repeatedly putting the question to Wilson, "Will you accept a compromise?" "No, I can't live with that." That was all he said, time after time, as the senator and Obey tried to force him to make some compromise. "No, I can't live with that." It was an extraordinary effort, and as Anuya's frustration level began to rise, an element of unreasonableness came to mark Wilson's position. He was not bending an inch. In Afghanistan earlier that year, Wilson had caused Brigadier Yusuf to see him as the lone cowboy standing up for the Mujahideen. Now, in the U.S. Capitol, this tall Texan in his bright striped shirt with his trademark epaulets and suspenders was once again standing alone, this time on the battlefield where he did his real fighting in the Afghan War. He was not acting as just another congressman seeking money for a campaign contributor. Charlie had a covenant to fulfill. For him, this was a deeply moral issue. He could feel the responsibility of speaking for the million Afghan dead, for the 6 million who had been displaced, for the army of freedom fighters just then going into battle with America's true foe. He was not about to let anyone take this war from him, from Zia, from the Afghans. This night he stood his ground and won. And so Zia remained the honored ally. The Mujahideen continued to shoot down Soviet aircraft at a rate of one a day. The full force of the training and of the Vickers mix of weapons was surfacing, and it was clear that time was on the side of the holy warriors. The all-night joint conference was not the sort of incident that would ever be recorded in a chronicle of a war. But it can be argued that the great event of the Afghan War in those critical last weeks of 1987 and the first few days of 1988 was what didn't happen in Washington because Charlie Wilson triumphed. The decision may well have already been taken in Moscow to end the Red Army's unhappy occupation. No matter what the outcome at the joint conference, the Soviets might have moved to withdraw anyway in precisely the same time frame. But perhaps not. All one can say is that Washington's strongest suit so far was its demonstration that, for once, it was committed for the long haul. When Zia survived the aid cutoff battle, there were no hopeful signs left for the hardliners in the Kremlin. In fact, they were now facing a movement that no one knew how to cope with. It was at this time that Eduard Shevardnadze drew his unexpected intimate, George Shultz, aside at Geneva to tell him secretly that the Kremlin had reached a decision to withdraw. Barring the unforeseen, Charlie Wilson's war was about to end.